Brian, the floor is yours.
Thank you very much. Well, welcome everyone to the summer 2014 webinar of the Advisory Panel on Rare Diseases. I'm Brian Luce. I'm the Chief Science Officer here at PCORI, and I'm really pleased to welcome you all. We have a very full agenda for the 3 hours ahead of us, and I'm just going to walk you down through the agenda as it is. I also want to note that we have 45 members of the public that have registered, and so I welcome you as well as, of course, the advisory panel itself. Following me, Marshall Sommer will provide us with a very interesting update on the leadership meetings that we have had in the past month or two. And then we're going to have some updates that we have titled Registry Projects. Sarita Wava will speak about the PCORINET. Russell Teagarden, a member of the advisory panel, will give us an update on NORD, and Yaffa Rubinstein on GRDR. They will be followed by myself, who will walk you through the topic generation and research prioritization process, which is very important for you to understand because it is the process by which we would identify topics of interest to the rare disease community. I will be followed by Desai Tafari, who will walk us through the PCORI's merit review process. Then Greg Martin, who's the Deputy Director of Stakeholder Engagement, will discuss the rare disease topics that have been submitted to PCORI in the past or up until now and what has happened to them. Naomi Aronson, who's a member of the committee but also a member of PCORI's methodology committee, will provide a short discussion on the cross-cutting rare disease issues as she sees them. Dave Hickam she'll be followed by Dave Hickam, who's the program director of our clinical effectiveness research program here at PCORI, and discuss rare disease issues associated with the CER topics. Then he'll turn the mic back over to Greg, who will discuss outreach and other solutions. And then Marshall and Vincent Delgaiso, the chair and co-chair of our panel, will do a recap and talk about next steps, and I'll contribute to that, and we all will as well. So it's an extremely packed agenda, but the panel really asked in its last meeting to be fully versed on many of the issues that we're going to be talking about today, and so we asked your attention for this packed agenda. And with that, Marshall, let me turn it over to you yes.
I just want to make a few housekeeping comments before we get started.
Oh, pardon me.
So if anybody has any questions, if you're part of the public and you have any questions, you can email us at advisorypanels@pcori.org, or you can also use the webinar chat. For the panelists who are on the line, this is just a reminder to virtually raise your hand if you have a question or a comment during any of the presentations or during the open discussion portion. And please keep your lines muted when you're not speaking. And for those of you who are on the phone and who will be presenting, I will be advancing slides, so if you need to prompt me, please do not hesitate to tell me to go to the next slide.
And could you do a roll call, Emma?
Yes.
For us, please.
Jacqueline Alicani?
Yes.
Jim Wu? Kate Lorig?
Yes.
Marty Gomberg-Maitland?
Yep.
Mark Skinner?
Yes, here.
Marshall Sommer?
Here.
Philip Russ?
Here.
Russell Teagarden.
Present.
Cindy Escobar Alvarez.
Here.
Uday Deshmukh.
Here.
Vincent Delgado.
Here.
Yaffa Rubenstein.
Here.
And Naomi Aronson.
Here.
Great.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you very much. So now I'd like to turn over the mic to Marshall to provide us with an update on the leadership meetings that we have had since our last full panel meeting. Marshall?
All right. Thank you very much. As Brian already pointed out, we've got a very jam-packed agenda today, so I'll try to keep this brief. A lot of what we're trying to do is things that came up in the leadership meeting center around trying to educate ourselves on what exactly CER research is going to be in the field of rare disease. We thought that was important based on some historical things and a couple of others. Next slide, please. The one with the faces. Let's, just in case y'all forgotten who's who, Vince and I are down here at the bottom. We forgot to duck, and we also thank you guys for recommending us for this. I think it's going to be a lot of fun. I'm actually very interested in this. But you can see at the top, Brian, David, and, of course, Emma, you should be on there, too, because, frankly, this thing doesn't run without you. Next slide, please. All right, so some of the things we've been talking about in the leadership committee is what we want to prioritize, and the discussion kind of centered around, do we prioritize specific questions and specific rare diseases? And since there are 7,000 of those, we wanted to take a step back from that and actually look at the PCORI process and how it fits in with the rare disease field. Since PCORI is mandated to do rare disease, but by and large, effectiveness outcome research is generated more around large populations. How do those two fit together? So we wanted to look at some of the issues around topic generation. How do you prioritize research when the population sizes are very small, so the actual impact of an individual question may not affect millions of people, but maybe only thousands or even hundreds? How does that play into the merit review for projects around comparative effectiveness outcomes research in rare disease? And how do we reach out to the community? So one of the things we spent some time talking about is, and we actually did this at the last meeting, as you may remember, is how do we reach the rare disease groups to get the information. We've identified some things around that. That should help us identify priority rare disease topics, but before we can do that even, one of the key elements of today's meeting is going to be educating us and myself included on how do you make a good CER question. In other words, what does it look like? How do you kind of judge it? And then the discussion later on is how do we think about incorporating that into our rare disease panel. The other thing we thought is actually we needed a little bit of a landscape review, and we kind of focused that around a number of things. One, we wanted to see what's out there already from the standpoint of registries, particularly around rare disease. We're going to see some presentations on that today. Standards of evidence. So as you all know, for any time you make a decision and you're using evidence for that, you need to be able to grade that evidence. So that's one of the things we want to try to look at. Biospecimens, what is out there from the standpoint of biospecimen repositories, things that can be used in PCORI-type research. And then, again, also looking at what are some of the current trends. I don't know if any of you have been following the new 21st century cures. They're talking about how to accelerate things through the FDA process. How do you look at the evidence? What do you use? And rare disease is actually going to be a chunk of that. So I think a little bit of thought about that, what's the current landscape on that, the grading systems for data we talked about a little bit, and then also cross-validating. Since a lot of the new registries are looking at patient-entered data and some have existing registries with physician or health professional-entered data, what's a good cross-validation process to show that? And there's a lot of evidence out there showing that that stuff works, but I think we might want to take a look at that specifically around rare disease. So we thought a landscape review might be a very worthwhile thing. The other thing we wanted to do is identify priority topics, talking to each other. Sorry, I already did that one. And then we want to look at PCORI's rare disease portfolio. During the first few submission cycles, they got a lot of things in. Not many rare diseases made it through, but when you look at the approved projects, there actually are quite a few that have a rare disease motif or include some rare diseases, so talk a little bit about that as well. Next slide, please. We also thought it would be very useful, since so much of this surrounds methodology, that we actually have a methodology person. So we've invited Naomi Aronson to become an ex officio member of our group. And those are kind of the main points I wanted to bring up now. Vince has got a couple of issues he wanted to bring up as well. Obviously, we're sharing the president's job here. But let me turn it over to you now, Vince.
So you were talking about topic generation, and one of the things that's very, very important is to be able to solicit patients to submit CER topics. And in order to do that, we're going to find out in a little while later on today, there's definitely a need for education on what is comparative effectiveness research. It has to be done in layman's terms. I come up with, like, when I think of comparative effectiveness research, I think of something that's done for people to learn what is a better way to treat a disease or condition. Things that can be compared are medications, devices, tests, surgeries, even things like how often medication should be taken. CER can be done by looking at medical records or by starting a new study specifically designed to answer a particular question. The other thing to keep in mind about soliciting the patients is you have to make it so that they care about doing it. Why is it important to them? And for me, the way that I look at this as a kind of a patient or a patient father is that the patient needs the best information available to decide on how to treat the condition. And, you know, the best way I look at that is an example. If I'm going to buy a TV set, I'm going to have access to a ton of information to help me decide what TV set to buy, size, whether it's a smart TV, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And that helps me guide my decision-making process. But when you're making a choice on how to treat a medical condition, there's often, like, no information available at all to the patient. So those two things have to be done in order to empower the patient to submit their own CER topics. And then once you do that, then you have to figure out a way to create a form where patients know where to go to submit the questions. And then one way and to keep the rare disease community engaged. So that's pretty much it.
So this is Marshall. Let me add one thing on to the end of that. One of the things we'd like to do, and the PCORI staff has been very gracious about talking about doing, is coming up with sort of a user's guide for comparative effectiveness, so for CER research, and also actually kind of coming up with sort of a checklist of items to consider when preparing a proposal. We think that'll, first off, ensure that more proposals get through, but also that we'll get a more predictable quality of the ones that are coming through. All right.
So we're ready to move on. Marshall, do you want to introduce people as we go along? Would you like me to?
I can do it. Either way. Brian, you've got everything right in front of you there. I've got it on my screen too, but why don't you go ahead?
Okay, fine. So thank you very much, Marshall and Vincent. We have had actually good discussions, and I think came up with some reasonable things to do. As we move forward, it's very clear that PCORI needs the guidance of this panel in order to get much more effective in addressing the rare diseases in terms of developing a comparative effectiveness research portfolio. One of the areas of deep interest to the rare disease community and to this panel, based on that first meeting, has to do with registry projects. And so we thought it would be important to update the panel on a number of registry issues, and we're going to start with Sarita Waba, who's one of the members of our CER Methods and Infrastructure program. And Sarita is going to talk about the PCORNet in the And a fairly deep role it has with respect to rare diseases. It's actually the highlight of our rare disease activity here at PCORI. Sarita?
Great. Can you all hear me? Great. Hi, everybody. My name is Sarita Waba, and as Brian said, I'm a program officer on the methods and infrastructure team. I'll talk to you today a little bit about what's going on in the rare disease PPRNs, but I just want to start by giving you a little bit of an overview of PCORnet in general, in case you've forgotten. So next slide, please. As you already know, PCORI's mandate specifically is to conduct comparative effectiveness research. And so what we're trying to do with the PCORnet initiative is actually to improve the efficiency for conducting this research. And it's not just for observational studies, but for clinical trials as well. And so what we're doing is we're building the technical capacity to do this, and we're also developing a set of patient-centered policies in order to make the network as a whole really gel together in a patient-centered way. Next slide, please. So this is just a quick overview of our components of PCORnet. We have 11 clinical data research networks. These are our systems-based networks. We've asked them to come in with a minimum population of 1 million, and oftentimes they will be connecting electronic health record data with claims data as well. We've also funded 18 patient-powered research networks, and this is really where we get a little bit more deeply into the rare diseases, because these patient-powered research networks have come together specifically around an individual condition or related conditions. And PCORI, during our merit review process in September, funded 9 rare disease PPRNs. Next slide, please. So some of the initial goals of the PPRNs were to establish a specific population size based on the prevalence of the condition. We asked for at least for the collection of patient report data or patient-generated information on at least 80% of the population. Of course, being PCORI, we've asked that the networks involve patients, caregivers, and other stakeholders directly in governance activities. And then they're all creating a standardized database that will be interoperable with the rest of the PCORnet network. Next slide, please. So moving into the rare disease PPRNs, I just want to kind of give you an update about what they're doing now.
Describe what a PPRN is. Not everybody in the listening audience may know.
Sure. So as I mentioned just before, the patient-powered research networks are networks. In some cases, the principal investigators are parents or caregivers or even patients. In other instances, they're researchers that have partnered with patient advocacy groups, and they've come together with the intention of doing research and speeding the efficiency for doing research around a specific condition. Again, nine of those being rare disease groups. So essentially, they're starting off, they're building their databases, some of them are existing registries. Others are building new registries. Some of them are merging registries. So all of this technical work is going on. They're also building patient portals and mobile apps so that patients can enter their data. But going back up to the first bullet point, they're also building their individual network governance policies, and they're also helping to contribute to the greater PCORnet policies that will exist for not only the networks that are involved in PCORnet today, but networks that will be participating in PCORnet research in the future. One of their biggest milestones was to enroll a specific number of people, and so what a lot of the networks are doing now is they've finished getting their IRB approvals, and they're reaching out and enrolling their patients. For those that haven't reached IRB approval yet, this is one of the main things they're working on currently, and then they'll start recruiting as soon as they do have that IRB approval. Okay. So in addition, they are developing and or updating their surveys, and so this means that they're figuring out what questions are really important to the patients who are going to be part of their network. Again, as part of the idea of incorporating patients into the governance activities, there are patients that are really involved in helping develop what those questions are going to look like. Many of the networks have developed patient-friendly informed consent, so making them much shorter and an easier-to-read language. They're also mapping to the PCORnet Common Data Model. So the version 1 of the PCORnet Common Data Model is out, and if you're interested in reading it, it's available on PCORnet.org. And so during this first version, the networks are going to be mapping demographic data, and then in future versions, they'll be able to map additional data like diagnostic data. They're also developing and testing computable phenotypes. They're doing this so that in the future they can collaborate with CDRNs and really help to identify either people who have already been diagnosed with their specific conditions, but also with the hope of developing, identifying people that have not been diagnosed quite yet but have those characteristics. And then lastly, they're building relationships with other networks, so it's really nice to see that the PCORnet networks as a whole are starting to coalesce around each other. Next slide, please. So here's just a sort of overview by number. 9 out of 9 of our rare disease networks are collecting demographic data. 6 out of 9 are collecting vital signs, and then almost all of them are creating enrollment, diagnosis, and encounter data, and the last undecided one will likely do the same. 2 of them have launched and started enrolling, and then the rest will be coming down the pike quickly. Here's some update about where we are with IRB approval. So 3 have already gotten their full IRB approval, and that's not only for enrolling patients, but also for their outreach materials. They all have their governance structures developed, and there are patients involved in governance in all of the networks. And next slide, please. So a few of the challenges and concerns that we've had. So one of the things we've heard a lot is that bringing the patients into the networks for some of these really rare diseases is not that hard. One of the concerns are about the best practices and retaining those patients and keeping their interest alive and in being involved in the networks. And we've also heard that there is concern about best ways to increase diversity. Another focus of upcoming activity will be outreach to clinicians. We think that in order to really get patients engaged in these networks, it will be important to engage the clinicians as well, so we're trying to figure out the best ways to do that. And then we've heard that there is a need for training materials to support the development of patient representatives. And one last concern that we've heard a lot is just a lack of structured data elements and computable phenotypes for rare diseases. Next slide, please. So this is our list of rare disease PPRNs, and it's pretty much my last slide. You can take a look at the populations that we're covering here. The one thing I didn't mention before is that in all of our clinical data research networks, we've also asked for them to come in with a rare disease cohort. So there are 11 additional rare disease cohorts that are going to be where there will be future research done. And then the last thing I'll mention is that we are working toward trying to get our rare disease task force leaders within PCORnet to attend the upcoming rare disease advisory panel meeting in October. So we're looking forward to seeing where there are synergies among both groups. And that's for my presentation. I'm happy to take questions if you have them, and I'm sorry if I went over my time.
Kate, you had a question?
Yeah, I can see that the PPRNs are kind of instrumental in determining what research is ultimately going to be done. And that certainly makes a lot of sense for larger disease groups. With rare diseases where we're representing 3,000 or more different rare diseases, basically by choosing the PPRNs, have we not already determined where the research is going to happen and left out the other 2,989 groups?
Well, the one thing I would say is that we are obviously piloting this first attempt with the groups that we've already funded. So the intention in general of what we're doing is to be able to make this scalable. And so, for example, there are networks, and I'll name one in particular. It's the Community Engaged Network for All. And they've developed a platform called the Peer Platform, and they're developing policies and guidelines so that it would actually be really easy and very cost-effective for future, not just rare disease, but common diseases as well, to be able to create their own registry from the existing platform. So the idea, again, behind our initiative is not just to fund research in the areas that we've identified, but to really make this scalable to many more conditions.
And this is Brian. Let me just jump in. These rare disease PPRNs were not specifically targeted by PCORI. We sent out an announcement for applications, and this is what came in. And as Sarita said also, the CDRNs, each one of them is to identify a rare disease cohort to develop, so that increases this. But by no means are we committed to only these rare diseases. They just happen to be the ones that successfully competed for this particular opportunity.
Brian, if I could add, this is Vincent Delgazzo, if I could add one more thing, too, because I'm pretty involved in one of the PPRNs. The way that I look at it is the existing PPRNs and CDRNs are actually building the network that will be copyable by other diseases. Are not actually doing the research with these by building this infrastructure.
Good.
Is that a good helpful way to put it, Sarita?
Yeah, I think that's exactly right, Vincent. Thank you.
So we should probably move on because we're going to, we've got such a crammed.
I've heard the explanation. I think there's a problem, but we'll move on.
Okay, fine. Yeah, we'll have plenty of time to revisit all these issues. Russell Teagarden from NORD is going to discuss NORD's registry projects and give us an update. Russell?
Right, thanks. NORD, I should say that patient groups creating and managing their own natural history studies and registries is just representative of the idea of rare disease anyway. I mean, rare disease is more than just a small number. It's generally represents these disease situations where patients themselves are the ones driving most of the advancements for various reasons, mainly because of the only ones. And so one of the natural history of the natural history studies in rare disease is often they try to do this as early as possible. Just to know, basically, number one, is there anybody out there, and who are you, where are you? And they quickly learn that it's an opportunity to advance other interests that they have. Obviously, research is one. Research and the search for treatments, et cetera, is a powerful driver. It's been going on for decades, but that's a very that typically tends to be sponsored by developers, and they tend to be narrowly focused as one in a rational sort of way. But the groups typically have broader interests. They're interested in gathering information that can help clinicians, oftentimes gathering information to draw attention of clinicians to issues that don't seem important to them but are to the patients, and also to be able to give families and and caregivers, et cetera, some sense of trajectory. You know, what's going to happen to me under a certain set of attributes, et cetera. So there's a broad range of interests, and they become critically important to rare disease groups. Now, NORD, as an umbrella organization, is in business to help build the capacity of these groups, bring expertise they don't have, show them the way, more or less, or provide platforms for them to use. And it became pretty apparent a couple of years ago that NORD would be a great place to locate capacity and capability for rare disease groups who want to run their natural history studies there. And there was a convergence of thinking then. Many groups thought that, NORD thought that, there was a lot of encouragement by FDA and NIH at the same time. And, in fact, the encouragement from FDA and NIH was not just in words but in actions. They've were willing and have formed a work group with NORD to help individual patient groups establish their questionnaires, establish the right fields in order to be sure that there's research-grade output. That was the interest of FDA and NIH, is because they've seen some of these groups that didn't always have the right expertise and produce output that wasn't usable, which is just utterly tragic. And so these were the driving forces. NORD is then did what it could to drawn on little financial wherewithal, but whatever was there, to put together the software and some people, and some great inputs from the likes of Marshall Summer and others to get it rolling. Rolling it is. There is one group that just went up from the Von Hippel-Lindau group, the VHL Alliance, is up and running domestically and nationally, and it's going well. That announcement is the announcement of that has been kind of passive. We haven't made a big deal about this, but just with the news of VHL going up, we have received a lot of interest from a lot of other groups. And so our rate of assimilation is dependent on funding and so forth, which we're making some progress on as well. So the idea here actually, at least as it's drawn up on the board, would be something like a PCORD net, maybe a little bit broader, maybe a little bit different structure, but the idea is the same, is to have a model set up that people can either run through there or base theirs on. So that's the basic idea.
Thank you very much, Russell. So I'm going to move right on, if I may, to Yaffa's presentation on GIDR.
Yaffa? Thank you very much for giving me the opportunity to present to you the overview of the GIDR program, which is the NIH NCATS program, and I'm going to talk very fast, so I will stay in the time limit. The Global Rare Disease Patient Registry Data Repository was initiated in 2010, where the concept was presented during an international workshop to all the stakeholders. Next slide. The vision of the program is to develop a learning program and a community that is engaged in common purpose that include patients and their families, advocates, clinicians, scientists, and the industry. The goal is to collect and disseminate data and knowledge to support clinical research, population health, improvements in health and quality of life of people with rare diseases as well as with common diseases. This includes creating a standardized interoperable data repository with open science principles, integrating patients' data from different rare diseases registries, mapped to the GRDR CDEs and other national standards to be available to the research community to develop various biomedical studies, including clinical trials. Stay on this slide because this is the slide. This slide illustrates how data is collected and integrated into the GRDR repository. Patient data collected into the patient registries, where each registry owns their data, and they share their de-identified data with the GRDR. As part of the de-identification, each data will be assigned a GUID, which is a global unique identifier, which will be facilitate the tracking of the data over time across studies, registries, and countries. The GUID will also facilitate linking the patient's information with their biospecimen data in the biorepository biospecimen database, RDHub. Data shared with the GRDR will be mapped to the GRDR CVEs and other national standards, which then will be available to the research community. We realize that there are and there will be other major databases of patient information which we would like to collaborate with and to link to. Next slide, please. This slide just illustrates example of one case, how one can access the data repository and retrieve the information to develop a specific study. Next slide, please. One of the keys for success, at least as I see it, is to collaborate and work with the best available expert matters with the most related experience. So we are very proud to work and collaborate with a team from Children's Hospital in Philadelphia, led by Dr. Chris Forrest, which had been with us since the conception of the GRDR. And we are looking forward to collaborate and create a working relationship with other major organizations such as NORD, PCORI, and other international organizations. Next slide, please. As I mentioned, a big part of the program is to develop tools for the community and to disseminate information. We have developed the GRDR common data elements to bring standardization in the way that patient data is collected, which has been adopted by many national and international organizations. We have developed a template for informed consent for participating in patient registry, which can be modified according to the specific need of each registry. We provide a software to assign the GUID. We map the registry data to the GRDR CVEs and national standards. We have the ability to link the two data sets of biospecimens and the patient information via the GUID. Other tools are in the pipe to be developed. And, of course, the GRDR website, which provide a lot of information and links to other resources. Next slide, please. The GRDR program has value for the patient and their families, to advocates, patient organization, as well as the investigator and the industry. Next slide, please. Additional information can be found in the list of related publications, as you can see it on the slide, and also I myself available to answer any questions that we have. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Yaffa. I appreciate that. So I'm going to walk you through PCORI's topic generation and research prioritization process. It's a fairly involved process, as you'll see. Next slide, please. Here's just a simple overview in which we gather topics through a very wide-ranging effort from patient stakeholders, community, and just generally. We evaluate, the PCORI staff evaluates the topics that come in and triages them. For those that are selected, I'm going to go into this more deeply in a minute. Topic briefs are developed. These are about a five-page brief as to what the topic is and the degree to which there's an evidence issue. These topic briefs are submitted to our advisory panels that prioritize the topics for us to consider for major studies and then ultimately topics that are selected for a targeted PFA, which would be a set-aside funding announcement for a particular topic with a specific question in mind, goes to the PCORI board for decision-making. So I'm going to go right to the next slide. which gets into all of this a little bit more in some depth. It's a, as you can see, it's actually quite a, well, it looks like it's a colorful process, but it's certainly somewhat involved. So from the far left, we are soliciting and accepting topics from multiple sources, as you can see here down the left-hand side. They are then screened for, each one of these topics screened for eligibility. I will go over those, the criteria that we use to screen for eligibility to be sort of in the mold of what PCORI considers patient-centered outcomes research. The topics then are selected through a process with our staff using a little bit more refined criteria to determine which topics are seem to be most appropriate for the advisory panels to consider. Those topics that are selected for that process are then each one of them has a topic brief developed. So those topic briefs are usually developed by academic groups that that contract with PCORI. As I mentioned, these are about 5-page briefs that have some depth to them that looks at the importance of the topic and the relevance to that topic for a patient-centered outcomes research study. The topics briefs are then passed by our a board committee, the Science Oversight Committee, the SOC committee, for their review and comment, and then are submitted to the advisory panels. Each one of our programs, our priority, national priority programs, which is addressing disparities, the clinical effectiveness research program, the improving healthcare systems program, and the communications and dissemination program. Each one of these programs in PCORI has its own multi-stakeholder advisory panel that consists of patients and patient advocates and other stakeholders, whether including, of course, researchers. And they do a very deep analysis of the topic briefs and meet for a full day, having already digested the topic briefs, and they discuss the topics that have been submitted to them and prioritize the topics for consideration as a formal targeted announcement to be funded by the research community. Next slide, please. The topics then are that have been prioritized by the advisory panel are considered by the staff and also reviewed by this Science Oversight Committee of the board. They're considered to be either a major topic to be developed into what we call a targeted PFA or a PCORI funding announcement, and this would mean that we would set aside a substantial amount of money, typically somewhere north of $10 million and up to so far $30 million, for a very specified question that has been identified that is appropriate to consider, and we solicit a proposals for that. Other topics will be listed in an announcement for our large pragmatic studies and other large trial program. These are typically around $10 million a piece of direct costs, $15 million total. And so we identify the specific topic without a specific question in mind, but identify the topic as topics of priority that the research community is invited to address and consider in terms of submitting a full application. Actually comes in as letters of intent first, but I won't go into that right now. And then finally, we have routine broad funding announcements a couple of times a year that are generally are interested in smaller studies, but we're apt to, in those announcements, note particular topics of special interest that come out of this whole process. So, in other words, the prioritized topics can either be selected for a targeted PFA, set aside listed in our pragmatic studies announcements, or our very more broad announcements as a special interest. And finally, some of them, the target PFAs, go through a board in a more formal process for decision making, and then are announced, and ultimately we go through the whole merit review process, which we'll be talking about very soon in terms of how we select topics. All of this, by the way, as I speak to you as a panel, is an extremely important process for you to understand, because it is this process that PCORI uses to determine where it wants to put its funding. And so the degree to which that has developed proposals and of interest to the rare disease community means it's a very important process for you to understand, and we believe you can help us a great deal in streamlining this process or retargeting this process so that it is more amenable to identifying important topics for rare diseases and the rare disease community. Next slide, please. So I just kind of quickly go over the various criteria that we use in each one of these steps. The first step, remember, is just to determine whether a topic is eligible to be considered for prioritization. It's a very basic screen. You can see the criteria are, is this an appropriate comparative effectiveness research question? Is it duplicative of another question already in our database? And specifically, is it patient-centered? Next slide, please. This is the first more intense screening process that the staff use to determine whether topic briefs will be developed to be submitted to the advisory panel. And here you can see it's the impact. This is the very top level criteria still. It's the staff's sense of the impact that the condition has on the health of individuals and populations. And it's important to note that it is targeted to not only populations, and therefore not just large populations, but small populations, for instance, in a rare disease community, and the specific health of individuals within that. The importance of the important evidence gap that is believed to exist, the degree to which a research that PCORI may fund could close that evidence gap, and the likelihood of that those findings from such a study could be implemented in practice and obviously improve health and improve patient welfare. Next slide, please. Topic criteria three, or tier three criteria, is what the advisory panel uses, and sort of drills down a little bit more deeply on those kinds of issues that I just mentioned in terms of patient-centeredness. And here they're actually literally prioritizing the specific topics that they have before them. So it's not just which group of studies or topics are of interest, but what is the relative priority of one topic to another. So they look carefully at patient-centeredness, the impact of the condition on the health of individuals and populations, the assessment of current options, the likelihood of the implementation in practice, and the durability of the information should be developed in research. So keep in mind that these advisory panels are working off of these topic briefs, so they have a lot more information in some considerable depth, and they're fairly well prepared to prioritize these topics. So the last criteria in Tier 4, next slide, please, is the criteria that's used to determine whether a topic is eligible, that comes out of the advisory panel that's prioritized, that's eligible for a set-aside amount of money, in which we call this targeted PFA. The criteria, as you see it here, is whether the specific question has been identified. So it's not just a topic, but it's a question within that topic. Usually it's a clinical, a very specific clinical question. Obviously, the importance of the topic is determined by the scores of the advisory panel, and whether it may require a higher level of funding, because the target PFAs typically have much higher level of funding than the other avenues that I mentioned. So that's the basic criteria, is to determine whether, in fact, it goes into the bucket of a targeted PFA or identified within the pragmatic trial identified topics of interest or the broad announcements. And I think that's it. Is that right? Okay, next. Okay, then you can move forward. And is Desai, are you here?
I am here.
Oh, good. I'm pleased you are. So I know that's a whirlwind, but I'm really concerned that we're not going to have time to get everything in, and we'll hopefully have time for questions. If not, we will convene again, of course, with the panel to go into these issues in any depth you want. So Sahai Tafari, who's the Senior Program Officer, and she literally runs our entire merit review process here at PCORI. She's an extremely important and effective individual, and she's going to talk to you through the whole selection process once we receive applications and how we go through this selection process. So if you will take over, Sahai, please.
Thanks, Brian. Thanks for the introduction, and thank you for the opportunity to speak to you today about merit review. Let's go on to the first slide. I just wanted to orient you about what our goal is with merit review, which is, of course, to identify the really strong applications that have the potential to improve patient outcomes. So, of course, we want to fund applications that can support our mission of providing better evidence for patients, clinicians, caregivers. Next slide, please. So this slide shows our full merit review cycle, and I think sometimes when people think of merit review, they think of just the bottom part of this slide, which is the in-person meeting. But as you can see, there are multiple steps and multiple inputs to get to the meeting and then to get to our final approval of our awarded applications. Next slide. So what I'm going to do is walk you through this process step by step. And Brian just did a really nice explanation of how we develop our targeted PFAs. We have two different types of PFAs that we issue, our targeted, but I won't go into that detail because I think Brian did a really nice job of explaining that process. But we also have broad PFAs, and those align with our national research priority areas. Next slide. The next slide actually shows these priority areas, and there are four programs that are more closely aligned in terms of the types of research that they fund, and those are assessment of prevention, diagnosis, and treatment options, which is more of our traditional CER, improving healthcare systems, communication and dissemination research, and addressing disparities. And our fifth program, Accelerating PCOR Methodological Research, focuses more on developing methods, and so it's a slightly different approach, and our review criteria for that program are different for the broad PFAs. But I do just want to note that in addition to our targeted PFAs, we do have broad calls for applications that fall into our national priorities areas for research. So on the next slide, I talk about the receipt process. The beginning of that process is after we've issued the PFAs, targeted or broad, we then receive letters of intent from our applicants. And for our upcoming cycle, we are doing what's called a competitive LOI screen. So we're going to be looking at those applications based on a few specific criteria, some of which are specified in the PFA. Oh, actually, all of them are specified in the PFA. And on the next slide, I talk a little bit more about what the specific content of that review entails. So the criteria for the review are in the PFA. And we, in addition to those criteria, we also screen our LOIs for the presence of comparative effectiveness research, of course, because we are mandated to fund this type of research to generate evidence, and also to make sure that those LOIs, the projects that are proposed, exclude cost-effectiveness analysis, which is not something that we fund at PCORI. So only responsive LOIs are invited to submit a full application. So that's that screening process, and these are the criteria that we use for the screening of the LOIs. And then based on the topic areas that we see in those received LOIs, then reviewer recruitment begins. So that's a really specific and targeted approach to identifying the best people to evaluate the applications. And you can see on the next slide how we engage different stakeholders in our processes. We do this, of course, in every step, everything that we do here at PCORI, we engage our stakeholders. And I'm really focusing today, of course, on merit review, where the top right quarter of this of the PCORI work, where review, design, and conduct of research. So this leads into the discussion of who our reviewers are. So our next slide really shows the different types of reviewers that we have on our panels. We do engage patient and stakeholders in our review process, which is very different from the way many other funding organizations review applications, in addition to our scientist reviewers. And so we really believe that this diversity of perspectives is critical for us to fund patient-centered evidence and get the information out there that people really need. So our patient stakeholder reviewers, and I just want to note that though we call them patient and stakeholder reviewers, stakeholders can, of course, be patients, and patients are stakeholders, so we ask them to represent a specific perspective on the panel. So although we recognize that it's a broader category, we ask them to focus on the patient perspective or the stakeholder perspective, and we do have quite a broad array of stakeholder types. So we ask them to participate in this way, and our scientist reviewers and chairs, of course, have to have that specific scientific expertise as appropriate to review the applications that we receive. So they have to have publications in a relevant field and current or recent funding also in a relevant field. And that's true for both our scientist reviewers and our chairs. So the things that these reviewers have in common is that they all have to be in support of our mission and vision and have experience with their areas of interest. So just to give you a sense, so we have received our LOIs and started reviewer recruitment, looking for reviewers in these three different categories, patient reviewers, stakeholder reviewers, and scientist reviewers. And then we receive applications, which is the next step in our little cycle. So once we've received our full applications, we then finalize the referral of those applications to the panels based on the topic areas. So we do this to make sure that we have the right reviewers grouped with the right applications. And at that point, our reviewers go into our system and look at the abstracts and lists of key personnel, identify any conflicts of interest and expertise. And this is an important part of our process to make sure that there's we're really making sure that it's a fair and thorough review. And then we assign applications to the reviewers. And that's the next step in the process. And in the next slide, you can see a little bit more detail about what that means for the reviewers. We do assign applications based on their expertise, as self-rated expertise, and also based on the COIs that the reviewers indicate. Each reviewer is assigned up to 8 applications to review in about 4 weeks. And we do provide extensive reviewer training for all of our panel members. Not only do we have web-based trainings that include program-specific modules, we also have program-led webinars during which reviewers can interact directly with program staff and ask any questions or points of clarification if they need them. We also have a mentor program specifically for our patient stakeholder reviewers as an additional support. And so the mentor program is run by our engagement team, and the mentors are experienced patient stakeholder reviewers who remember what it was like to do this for the first time and help orient our patient stakeholder reviewers to the review process at large. So it's working specifically with them on how they craft their critiques, how they score applications, feeling comfortable in the panel room. And our chairs also work with the entire panel to make sure that the panel dynamic is such that we actually can hear those diverse perspectives in the panel room. So this is application assignment. Then we move into preliminary review, which is the time where all of our reviewers are looking at their assigned reviewers, evaluating the applications based on our review criteria, looking at methodology standards adherence, their writing critiques, and developing their critiques and scoring applications. And on the next slide, you can see our review criteria. And I should note that this set of criteria is specific to all of our broad national priority areas. So these are the criteria we use for the broad PFAs. For the methods program, these are slightly different because they do have this focus on PCOR methods. But this is just for illustration, just to give you an idea of what the types of things we're looking for and we ask our reviewers to think about when evaluating applications. So you can see that there are checkboxes in these two columns for the different reviewer types. We ask all of our scientist reviewers to focus on all of the, to review all of five of our review criteria. And we ask our patient stakeholder reviewers to focus on criteria 2, 4, and 5. And they may, of course, comment on the other criteria should they feel comfortable doing so, but we ask them to focus on those three. So the way that these criteria kind of break down, we really look at impact of the condition on the health of individuals and populations. So this is really where burden is evaluated, burden on the population. Criterion 2, potential for the study to improve healthcare and outcomes. This is where the applicant must describe the evidence gap and how their project will provide evidence to fill that gap. Technical merit, of course, most of our scientists are more familiar with this type of a criterion where we're looking at study design and also methodological rigor. Patient-centeredness, very important criterion for us, whether or not the project is going to generate evidence and information that's important to patients. And then patient and stakeholder engagement, how the proposed work has engaged patients and other stakeholders from conception to dissemination. So that's just really broad brush on our review criteria, but I do want to focus your attention to one part of our first criterion, impact of the condition on the health of individuals and populations. I just want to point out that we do focus on how the condition or disease can impose a significant burden on a smaller population, for example, a smaller number of people who have a rare disease. So I just wanted to make it clear that this is something that's important to PCORI, and this is included in our review criteria. And each of those criteria have multiple sub-bullets that kind of specify and provide a little bit more information. And I just wanted to point out to the group how we think about evaluating burden on smaller populations with rare disease. Okay, so on our next slide, I also want to point out our methodology standards. We do have a set of standards that we ask all of our applicants to adhere to, and these are really critical, of course, because the information that we generate, we want it to be trustworthy, and so we feel that having these methodology standards will help support help us generate trustworthy information. So all of our applicants are asked to adhere to these, and our reviewers do evaluate adherence to the methodology standards. Okay, so the next slide shows our scoring scale, and it is a scale with the lower number actually representing a better application and a higher number representing a poorer application. So 1 to 9, low score is good, high score it has some serious weaknesses. And you can see that we ask people to think about fine-tuning their scores based on how major, minor, or moderate the weaknesses or strengths are in the application using our review criteria. So each criterion receives a score, and also we ask our reviewers to provide an overall score for each application to which they're assigned. One thing that I did not note here, and I'm sorry that I'm doing this late, is, you know, I did mention that we have different reviewer types on our panels. We assign 4 reviewers to each of our applications, 2 scientists, a patient, and a stakeholder. And I'll tell you a little bit more about what that looks like in the panel room discussion in a moment. So we have just finished reviewing applications. All of our assigned reviewers have scored and written critiques, scored criterion, provided overall scores for all their assigned applications. And then those score reports, including the criteria scores, come to our program staff. And the programs set what we call the discussion line. So applications above that line move forward in the process, but about half of the applications stop at this point. So it's based on an evaluation of the scores, both overall and criterion. Okay, so this identifies the applications that will move forward in the process. So then we've moved on to the in-person meeting, and this is where the applications are discussed by the full panel. So In that full panel meeting on our next slide, we show exactly what our process is for each application that comes forward at that point. So can you move to the next slide? Great, thank you. So as I mentioned, we have 4 reviewers assigned to each application, and the order on this slide shows the order in which they are assigned and also the order in which they present their critiques to the full panel. So the chair introduces the application, and then the 4 assigned reviewers in the order that you see at the top of the slide summarize the application strengths and weaknesses and why they've scored it as they have. Once the assigned reviewers provide this information, then there's a general panel discussion that's facilitated by the chair. After the discussion is complete, The chair verbally summarizes that discussion of the application, and that's recorded for our merit review officers to use and provide discussion notes that come along with in the summary statement with the reviewer critiques. And then the full panel scores the application in our online system. So the next step for our merit review officers specifically, and I put this in the order that I did is because we like to have our summary statements complete before we move too far along in this process. But summary statement production is an important part of the work that we do around merit review. Our programs work with our merit review officers to draft discussion notes from the in-person meeting to make sure that there's an appropriate capture of the main points of that discussion so that the applicant has more information. So on our next slide, I just wanted to point out that there are two different types of summary statements that we send to our applicants. Those for the applications that are discussed, and then those for applications that are not discussed. And the main difference is that the discussed applications have preliminary reviewer critiques and notes from the application discussion. They also receive a final panel average overall score. So that's the average overall scores from the full panel. The applications that are not discussed at the in-person meeting receive the preliminary reviewer critiques and the average overall score from the four assigned reviewers. So it's just important that you're aware of what the content is and the differences in the content in the summary statement. So our next slide shows how the program staff use the scores from the in-person meeting to set their funding slates. So on the next slide, there's a little bit more detail. The programs present... There's a slide missing here. Okay. So programs go through their score reports, and they are looking, they're providing portfolio information to the selection committee. And so they're talking about this is our PFA, this is what we asked for in our PFA, this is what we saw at the in-person meeting, and this is why we've chosen the applications that we've chosen for funding. So they provide this information to the selection committee, and they discuss that information and before the selection committee makes a recommendation to the board. So on the next slide, it just basically is the information that I just described about the purpose of this is really just to facilitate the selection of applications that best support our mission, you know, so that we can recommend those forward to the board. And so the final step in our merit review process is that Board of Governors meeting where they review our funding slate and approve it, and this is a public meeting. So often applicants are listening in for the good news. This is also where this is the same date on which we release our summary statement. So everyone gets their summary statements at the same time when we announce all of our awardees. And so that was very fast. I was trying to not go too far over my time. If you have any questions, I'll be happy to answer them now.
Yeah, and we do have time. Thank you, Sahai. Are there any questions of Sahai or of me of the as to the prioritization process?
This is Marshall Summer speaking. Those were great reviews, and I definitely want to encourage the rest of the panel, ask questions about this, because this is at the heart of what we're trying to get at, is how do we bring rare disease to this process. Anybody out there?
Hi, this is Mark Skinner. The question I had, and I was, as I look back at the charter for this committee and I look at the enabling legislation, there is provision for the creation of ad hoc advisory panels to assist in evaluating, designing, and conducting the research. So I'm wondering if there's been thought given to when and how an ad hoc expert advisory panel for a particular rare disease might need to be established to evaluate or to look at the design of the proposals within the review process that was just laid out.
That's a great question. As far as I know, we don't yet have those in place, but it's certainly something that I can't see why we wouldn't be able to find a way to integrate that, and especially if we're thinking about strengthening the applications that we want to fund, identifying strong applications and making sure that we're getting what we need out of that. But I'll defer to Brian. I don't know if he had anything else to add to that.
Well, it does go to the core of why we are interested in having a rare disease advisory panel, and I presume it actually goes to the core of why Congress literally required it. Because the concern is that that a typical process of soliciting funding for important research and then the process of identifying topics and identifying high merit proposals can disadvantage the rare disease area, which I think politically and socially everybody agrees is extremely important. So we literally need advice in this regard, and this is what I actually throw it back to the panel. If we had the answers to all of this, we wouldn't need you. Dave Hickam is next to me, and he's closer to this issue and has had an opportunity to prepare under his direction topic briefs, discussions within his advisory panel, and, of course, the entire merit review process and ultimate selection of research that includes rare disease applications. So, Dave.
Yeah, I think it's really a great question, and I think a big part of this is sort of where in the sequence. I think Sahai described a process that has many steps, and I think there is potential for sort of ad hoc advisory panels on rare disease topics to contribute to the review process. The question is where along all these steps should that occur? I mean, I think a logical place where it could occur is before, you know, potential projects go for final decisions at PCORI. You know, the last step is that sort of Board of Governors approval of the slate. So I think it's worth thinking about where sort of preliminary to that step input could occur from, you know, these special groups. The other thing is that there's also potentially a role for that kind of input after a project starts, you know, sort of a, an ongoing consultation process for these projects.
In terms of design of the study and so forth?
Yeah, and actually sort of implementing the study plan.
Yeah, right.
So I think that that's, that would be, as this panel gets the opportunity to get, more well acquainted with the review process, I think it's good to have a discussion about sort of how to insert these steps into the process.
And this is Sahai. I'd also like to add that I think that the PFA development process is really key as well. The more specific and we can be in those documents, the better inputs we'll get. So that's another place to think about incorporating the panel.
Uday, you have a question?
Yes, more than a question or comment, actually. I'm trying to understand because two things. One is that as we go through this process in terms of reaching a state of approval, the way I was thinking about it was that we would have refined their question to a point where we know exactly what clinical question would be answered in terms of this research and what outcome we are expecting, which would be the presentation that would be going to the board. Now, based on this comment coming in that we can keep modifying it after the fact, I wanted to understand if whatever the, because I thought what advisory panel is going to present to the board may get voted down on some of the items by the board. So at least in my thinking, I thought it was more appropriate to pre-work it before it goes to the board. Otherwise, the board may look at it differently and may turn down something that we may think is very valuable because it hasn't been prepared properly.
Yeah, yeah. That was Dave's point. And you are absolutely correct. Selecting the the point within this whole process is strategic in and of itself. And there's, I'm certain they more than one part in the circle of multiple activities that we go through. The panel needs to think through where it can best and how many individual places and exactly what role it would play in terms of helping us.
So let me ask a follow-up question on that as to, as we're trying to refine this process and we would be looking at a slate of requests coming in, I'm almost looking at it like, you know, the way we look at a quality loop. There could be multiple loops going on. Is that going to be too much of a pressure in terms of trying to meet the administrative demands from the staff and the committee in terms of reworking them, or are we planning to break it down into smaller groups? Or is it better to have at least some rules of the road or some sort of a guideline that we want to provide as it pertains to rare disorders to those who will be submitting the application, so that the material that is getting submitted to the committee for review has a level of quality that we expect from it?
This is Kara Walker from PCORI. I think you're absolutely right that our merit review process has multiple parallels working at the same time always. So as you see, as Sahai has described this loop, we have multiple announcements that are being reviewed and posted and undergo review, where rare disease proposals may come in. They may come in to any of our national priority areas, not only CER, which Dave Hickam represents, but also improving healthcare systems, communication dissemination. And so you can imagine that those...
Or disparities,
absolutely. And so you can imagine that there are multiple pathways, and one of the questions that Sahai just raised is, do we, you know, create sort of the strategic question is, do you allow it to continue to be embedded within national priorities? Do you create a set-aside in some way so that you concentrate the proposals that come in for rare disease and review them differently, again, through a separate parallel track? And these are all questions that we want to address with the panel today, because we can think about specialized review or other ways to solicit proposals that are more in line with what the panel would like to see us funding in the end. And the board absolutely is looking for guidance on this as well, because right now they get recommendations from our review process that come in a bulk, you know, in a bulk presentation. They don't necessarily hear the details of the proposal. Our external reviewers do a lot of work for us in terms of selecting the most meritorious applications and those that we want to fund.
One follow-up question. Have there been situations where the board has actually sent some of the applications back to the teams to refine them based on their expectations?
No, I would say they have twice. Yeah, not the board or the one of the committees.
One of the committees.
Yeah, so indirectly the answer is yes. Now, if you don't mind, I want to move on.
Let's go ahead.
Okay, Cindy has a question as well.
Hi, thank you. So my question is, based on the comments that were made, is there an idea of just setting aside an amount of funds directly for rare diseases, or also what is the timeline? You know, you presented two processes. One is the selection of the topics, and the other one is the process from RFA to selection of a project. So do you envision a staff having, you know, a number of RFAs per year, or do that based on the funds that would be allocated for rare diseases?
We do not have any set aside for rare diseases at this stage. The rare disease topics at this point are competing with all conditions, any other conditions. So that's part of the answer to your question. What was the
other question was about timing, and I would say that because we have these two pathways, one is it goes through our funding announcement and through merit review, any investigator-initiated proposal from start to end takes about 9 to 10 months, depending on where the review is, between the time someone we post the funding announcement, it gets reviewed, and then we would have board approval for those projects, those awards. For topics, it's a little bit different because that is something that goes through our advisory panels and then is developed into a targeted funding announcement. And so that pathway leading up to the point before the start of this cycle that's posted right now, that's displayed on your screen, is usually anywhere from 3 to 6 months, where we take in a topic that comes in from stakeholders or from our panels and then is prioritized and reviewed by our board, and then we decide whether there would be a fund set aside out of our research budget and, again, approved by our board as a separate funding announcement before proposals come in and are reviewed in our standard merit review cycle.
And to date, history has shown that the biggest concern that we would have relative to rare diseases is that the topic selection process and prioritization process that comes through the system that I described and goes through the advisory panel and so forth has not worked well in the rare disease area, but that's not so been true with our broad solicitations that have investigator-initiated research. There we have received, I don't have at the top of my head the number of applications, but the applications have done fairly well. We've got how many? Probably?
Maybe 20 or 30, and we've funded,
what?
Between
10 and 15. So we funded somewhere between 10 and 15 studies, and Dave is estimating, but it's really just a guess. We're talking about maybe something like 20 or 30 applications. If that's the case, it's a very high rate of acceptance.
We need to do the math on that one.
Yeah,
so we'll get back to you.
But my point is that it's the topic selection process that has not been has not been productive at all.
Yeah, thanks.
Welcome. Next is Kate. You have a question?
Yeah, I actually have a comment and an idea, and that is, and it directly relates to the topic selection, that there is another way, at least with some of your grants, of going about this and getting information, and that is that if somebody's, for example, making a health services research, doing something in the systems change, there is no reason that we can't ask them or actually put it as part of the RFA, that RPA, that they give us data on how that change affects people with rare diseases. Because it may advantage them, it may disadvantage them, but we'd never know the way these things are written now. And so there may be some ways of writing these things that we get information about the effects of changes, at least in some of these comparative effectiveness things, on people with rare diseases without actually spending any more money than is being spent now.
That's actually a very interesting idea to consider. Absolutely.
Not well stated, but at least you got the nut of it.
Yeah.
At a kernel of the world.
Thank you. We're going to have to start thinking about moving on. What time is it? It's almost either. So we actually have a little bit more time if there are any other concerns that people want to raise or any comments that Sahai or anyone around the table, Dave, may have. But you're touching on, go ahead.
No.
Okay. This conversation, I think, is an extremely important one to follow up because that's, no matter what we do, if we don't have a process that works for the rare disease community and rare diseases in general, all of which we're doing is for naught. So this is just plain important no matter what else we do going forward as a panel. Okay, with that, I'm pleased to introduce Greg Martin, who's the Deputy Director of Stakeholder Engagement here at PCORI, He is now going to actually take some, move forward in some of the things we've just been talking about. He's going to talk about the rare disease submitted topics, how they fared, and maybe can tee up some more questions that we may have. Greg.
Thank you, Brian, and thank you, Marshall and Vincent, for having me here today to talk about some of the topics that we've had submitted so far. I also, like many others, want to recognize Emma for all of her hard work and help around this. So if you go to the next slide, please. This gives you the quick overall summary of the topics that have been submitted to PCORI so far and where rare disease falls into it. And I note that we did do another check as recently as Monday, and did not find any additional rare disease topics submitted. So as of mid-June, we had 1,807 total topics submitted to PCORI, of which only 53 concerned rare diseases. And this was across 31 conditions. We'd note that one condition was mentioned six times, ARVD, arrhythmogenic right ventricular dysplasia. It's a leading cause of sudden death among young athletes, but can affect people of all ages and all activity levels. About 60% of the topics were about a specific condition. 11% were submitted by caregivers of rare disease patients. And 33%, one-third, were submitted by rare disease patients themselves. Unfortunately, though, the vast majority of these topics are not fully formed CER questions yet, which I think is a good way of queuing up my friend Dave Hickam, who will be speaking next about how to formulate CER topics. Certainly that's an area where we would like to see this additional guidance that we have around how to craft CER questions come into play and hopefully get some better topic suggestions in, or rather some topic suggestions that are more ready to go immediately for PCORI's consideration. So if we go to the next slide, you can see some examples that we wanted to frame up here before we hand it over. And it's cross-cutting versus condition-specific topics. And this is something that we spoke about at the last panel meeting. So for an example of a cross-cutting CER rare disease topic, we came up with, is molecular genetic testing more effective than traditional clinical methods for diagnosis of rare diseases? And for an example of a rare disease-specific topic, we came up with, is early bone marrow transplant treatment for children affected by adrenoleukodystrophy, ALD, more effective than late bone marrow transplant treatment? So a couple of different ways of approaching this, we think, that we would submit for your consideration, and around which we would certainly welcome your feedback. We'll have time later on in our session today to discuss additional outreach to the rare disease community, so I'd like you to keep this subject in mind when we get to that point. But any feedback that you have, having seen the list of the topics that were submitted, and feedback you have on how we can generate some additional strong topics for consideration is welcome and wanted. So with that, I will...
I just have one comment to make, that out of the 53 topics that were submitted, only two made it to advisory panel prioritization, including actually the example of the rare disease-specific topic that's on the screen right now. That one was prioritized by Dave's panel.
Yeah, but good news. We have one more that's coming through for the advisory panel meeting in September. So, but, yes, they've been... They've not had high representation among the topics that have been reviewed by the panels.
Yeah, this is Marshall. This is kind of one of the reasons I wanted to go through this process today, and I think the staff at PCORI was kind of on the same page, as we want to make sure that we're seeing, okay, why aren't we getting more and why aren't they fitting better? And some of it, I think, is perceptions on both ends. So I really appreciate this.
Yeah, and this is Brian again. We can think of this, I guess what you mean by both ends, but you can think of this as a problem with our process, and you can also think of it as a problem with what comes into us in terms of the importance of the topic and the information that that we have in terms of the need for study, the evidence gap, the importance, in terms of health impact and durability and so forth and so on. So it goes to absolutely both, and we should think of it that way. Okay, so that's, I think we can move forward then. Naomi, I'm hoping you're still with us.
Of course I am.
Of course you are. We can always count on you, Naomi. Thank you so much. You wanted to, we want you to discuss cross-cutting rare disease issues. I know that you have had a long-standing interest in this area and certainly plenty of experience in your role. So why don't you take over and tell us what you have to say.
Okay. Thank you, Brian. I've got an echo. Is it affecting others, or are you okay? Can you hear me?
We can hear you fine.
Okay,
yes.
Good. No problem then. So this is my own opinion that probably PCORI will need to balance the portfolio with both cross-cutting and disease-specific issues. It's quite formidable, 7,000 rare diseases. How can you prioritize that and cover the whole waterfront in terms of topics? I faced this question in miniature in a work we did for ARC, looking at allogeneic bone marrow transplants, pediatric uses. This included autoimmune diseases. This included refractory cancers. This included inborn to errors metabolism. And once we finished this enormous work, we were tasked with prioritizing future research needs. And it just seemed untenable to be prioritizing these diseases or conditions. So what we searched for were cross-cutting issues. Interestingly enough, the one that emerged in that setting was as the top for all these families were the transfer, the care coordination from the bone marrow transplant setting when they got home to how were they, for their child, going to manage these complex regimens, both pharmaceutical and the follow-up care in the community setting. It was quite formidable. That was the issue. And so based on that experience, some recent conversations I've had with individuals, and also the opportunity to have the benefit of a focus group type discussion that involved multiple rare diseases, have tried to provide some classification of what are cross-cutting issues. First, I'm going to pull out methodologic issues. They have been referred to here. They are not, has been pointed out, strictly CER issues or strictly a CER question. They are the foundation for accomplishing CER. So I identify three here, which I think have been touched on, but I would want to emphasize with the first bullet, methodologic issues and standards of research in rare diseases, that it is important to look at methodologic issues in the primary research, that it's not just in our strength of evidence frameworks for systematic review, but the questions of maximizing methodologies to be as rigorous as possible in the settings of limited populations, and also understanding that we've got a great deal of variation in rare diseases, ranging from those where the diseases are only a few to those where one could conceivably gather a fairly substantial population for research. And there is heterogeneity in many other respects, including the uniformity of disease or the differences in presentation, the course of disease, whether it's highly progressive or relapsing, remitting. All of these affect the ability to carry on the research. So I think it is important to talk about primary research. There's a lot of interesting research being done in methodology, so I think it's an opportune time. We have talked a bit about the strength of evidence framework for systematic review. I would only add that an element of this is uncertainty. And it comes up not only in rare disease, but also in the question of treatments for life-threatening diseases, for example, in something like the FDA accelerated review process. That is when you have a situation with serious unmet medical need. Are we willing to tolerate both at a personal preference level and a policy level? What level of uncertainties are acceptable? With respect to standard definitions and taxonomies, I think it's been said better than others, but it's the need both within the clinical disciplines to have common definitions of severity or regimens, and to have within the registries and the recording of these common data elements addressed quite well by others who've preceded me in the presentations here. Next slide, please. So here we want to get to cross-cutting research issues. And I would say, as I have listened to conversations, all of these have been descriptive of what I would call quality of life circumstances. And what we hear is very descriptive. And the challenge to us is to identify what is the CER question here. So in the next slides, I'm just going to highlight the three umbrellas or buckets into which I've categorized these, or how they strike me. And I am going to, at risk of being silly, give some examples of what might be an intervention that could be studied. We've got a panel here that has great depth and breadth in the area of rare diseases, and I'm sure your examples will be better than mine, but I want to stimulate thought. So the first umbrella and bucket are diseases or treatment symptoms, and there are many symptoms that are common across multiple diseases, not only rare diseases, but common diseases. Consider, for example, fatigue. Consider depression and anxiety, neuropathies, GI symptoms and management of diet, adverse events and toxicities, the often unaddressed and sensitive manner of sexual activity. So let me just hypothesize an intervention. Let's take fatigue, for example. A comparative effectiveness topic, not quite a question yet, might be the concept that should patients with rare diseases and probably other patients, should there be some kind of standard evaluation for fatigue, the presentation fatigue and causes of fatigue, to identify those that are manageable? You know, perhaps there's an underlying sleep apnea. Perhaps there's a medication that is sedating. What would it mean to introduce something like this as part of the common workup? And the comparison might be to usual care. I will, obviously, usual care is something we struggle with defining, but what would it mean to introduce such an intervention? Would it improve those symptoms across a variety of diseases? Next slide, please. A common source of difficulty is the navigating of care. Simply being diagnosed when one has a rare disease and getting on the appropriate referral pathway. We know the tension of that physicians have of, are they observing zebras or are they observing horses? There is, and I have referred to that in the bone marrow transplant case, the coordinating of complex care. The self-management, the settings of adults and children are different and make different demands on the family, caregivers and patients. And there is the formidable issue of the cost of care. So let me take the cost of care, which very challenging to wrap your arms around of. So let me imagine this. Suppose we had quality of cost of care improvement committees across a variety of diseases. And within that disease, they looked for ways to make the care more efficient. Obviously, one of the drivers of cost are the huge cost of specialty drugs. And I think that's a little bit out of our scope here to figure out how to fix. But could you fix the care pathway so that it saved money in one area and allowed more flexibility in another? And suppose these pathways were successful, then one might reduce the cost of care and perhaps even from a payer's point of view, create new opportunities for benefit design that would be beneficial for patients. Next slide. And then the next slide is the social environment. Identified were employment, family relationships, and social relationships and the social network more broadly. So again, a hypothetical, you know, maybe just pushing the envelope, but I do want us to start thinking of systems and processes within which care occurs, because my sense is that the cross-cutting issues will be more about interventions in delivery and interventions in support systems rather than specific clinical interventions. So I suppose there could be exceptions. So let's imagine employment. Obviously, anybody with a chronic disease or condition may have issues with needing flexibility in employment, periods where they're not able to perform. And certainly we have medical leave provisions that are supposed to address that. But how well are employees able to access them and how well are employers able to understand these? Maybe there would be a sort of model agreement and performance type contract. I'm making this up. And one might try that in some settings, comparing it to usual settings, and see if, in fact, it improved employment performance, improved employment security, and perhaps with that stressor relief might even mitigate some of the contribution of stress to the disease itself. Just speculative. So those are my three buckets, the cross-cutting issues of disease or treatment symptoms, the issues of navigating care, and those of the social environment. And I just present them to you as a way to begin thinking about how can we generate cross-cutting CER topics.
Thank you very much, Naomi. Are there any questions or comments for Naomi?
This is Marshall. That was a great review, Naomi. I think you're highlighting some of the things we've got to think about as we're moving forward. Thanks very much.
Thank you.
So with that, and we can come back. We're going to have time, I think. It looks like we're doing pretty fine with respect to time. In this next session, Dave Hickam is going to, I think, go back to some basics that Dave likes to talk about regarding what comparative effectiveness research is, and you present this to many audiences, correct?
A few. Yes.
And I think it's important for the panel to hear what Corey thinks and how it views comparative effectiveness research and what it tells, especially what it tells its applicant community. And as you listen to Dave, listen to it with the ears of a rare disease community. And a researcher that's interested in rare diseases to see what message you're getting and whether the degree to which, I should say, what he's saying seems consistent with the issues and opportunities and needs associated with doing comparative effectiveness research in rare diseases. Is that a fair way to set you up, Dave?
Yeah, that's good. Thanks, Brian. So I think also that some of the comments that Greg Martin made a little earlier are quite relevant to this, because I think Greg made the point that when trying to think about nominations of topic priority areas for PCORI, sometimes there seem to be some questions about how does this fit into comparative effectiveness research. So as you all know, the original legislation that created PCORI used the language that said that PCORI's purpose was to develop research on clinical comparative effectiveness. And so, that really created, it said there's a certain type of research that PCORI would support. And then it also led to the terminology of patient-centered outcomes research, which in my opinion is really just the model of comparative effectiveness research that's being really communicated by PCORI. So I think the terms comparative effectiveness research and patient-centered outcomes research are pretty much interchangeable. So just make sure that when you hear us talk about PCOR, we're really talking about the same thing. Maybe we could go to the next slide. And so, so what's the starting point of comparative effectiveness research? Well, I think that the starting point is to examine choices that patients, their caregivers, and their providers make among options for managing a disease. So kind of the model here is that for any clinical condition, there is usually more than one way to go. And people are confronted with choosing, one way of trying to make the diagnosis of the cause of problems. Often it is choices about treatments, about, one treatment strategy versus another. Very nice example that was given a little bit earlier in this webinar was the one about adrenal leukodystrophy and the choice between early, basically bone marrow transplant when a child is at a very young age versus a strategy of sort of waiting for the disease to progress further before considering a bone marrow transplant. That's a choice that providers and families would need to make. Whenever you think about these choices, you need to think about the benefits and the harms that are associated with whatever choice that you make. Then this gets into the area of clinical evidence, is what is the evidence base? What do we know about the rates of benefits and the rates of harms between two alternative options that could be pursued? And if there isn't very good evidence, that's where there is a need for comparative effectiveness research. And so the slide that you see up right now really has to do with the way this sort of approach to comparative effectiveness research starts to look across the PCORI 5 national research priorities. So PCORI has 5 program areas that the Board of Governors indicated were its priority research areas. And how you think about comparative research in those areas looks a little different, and in one case, it looks very different. So basically, you kind of go down these 5 bullets. The first bullet really has to do with our program that's called the Assessment of Prevention, Diagnosis, and Treatment Options, in which we're looking for studies to compare the effectiveness of 2 or more strategies for the prevention, treatment, screening, diagnosis, or management of a condition, and also in some cases to compare system-level approaches But I think what you see here is this is very broad-based. It doesn't designate, you know, any one disease. But to think about all of the various clinical scenarios in which choices are made. Then PCORI has a improving healthcare systems program. And the second bullet would be an example of a comparative research question that would be in that program, which is, comparing factors that may affect patients' adherence to treatments, or more specifically, comparison of programs to improve adherence for getting better care of a particular condition. The next one, the next bullet, is that we also have a disparities program, and we're particularly looking at comparative options for basically surmounting and improving disparities in healthcare. Next, the communication and dissemination program at PCORI is looking at alternative approaches for improving really the dissemination and implementation of best evidence into the decision-making apparatus of healthcare. And then finally, the last program, which is the one that really isn't comparative effectiveness, is PCORI's methods research program. It's basically projects that are focused on improving insights about the methodology to be used in patient-centered outcomes research. And so these are going to be projects that are really looking at whether particular innovations might improve that methodology. Mm-hmm. And then finally, sort of the companion to the methods program is the infrastructure program, the PCORnet initiative, which is a very large initiative at PCORI, in which it's really building the data infrastructures, as Sarita Waba had described for you a little bit earlier in this webinar. So then we can go to that next slide. So what we communicate from PCORI is that there are some key features of the research that we support. First, there's kind of this real-world issue that we are interested in projects to study the benefits and harms of alternative interventions and strategies that are delivered in real-world settings. In other words, practical projects that study real-world populations with the belief the studies in those kinds of settings will produce information that can be more easily disseminated and implemented, because it's information about the same kind of patients that would potentially use and benefit from the new information that's produced by the research. I think, as you've already learned, these projects should compare at least two alternative approaches, at least in our four core funding areas. It also should be based on health outcomes that are meaningful to the patient population, the outcomes that are important to people. This is kind of the kernel of patient-centered outcomes research, that you think about, you do the appropriate engagement to learn what the important outcomes are, and you make sure that your study addresses those outcomes. You're not just measuring things that are convenient or easy to measure. You're measuring the outcomes that people care about. And finally, that the projects fill an important evidence gap, that these are important projects, that they do have a high likelihood of improving current clinical practices. Next slide, please. And then when we think about sort of topics of interest at PCORI, we communicate to the world that we are interested in particular areas. First, conditions that heavily burden patients' families and or the healthcare system. So there are important medical problems for which new evidence would be valuable. We do call out that there's an interest in chronic and multiple chronic conditions. We also call out that we're interested in rare diseases. So PCORI does communicate that we're interested in projects on rare diseases. And finally, we're interested in this issue that's called heterogeneity of treatment effects, or how the benefits and harms of alternative clinical approaches might vary among important patient subgroups. So we're interested in projects that are able to look at those subgroups. I think this gets into some of our disparities interest, but it also, I think, has to do with the idea that there are some segments of the population with particular conditions that might have different experiences with healthcare interventions than other patient groups.
Just to go back for a second, the rare and understudied conditions is literally embedded in our announcements and our funding announcements. So it's a routine message that we send out to the community that submits applications. Correct? Mm-hmm.
Yes.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So you know, if you're wanting to develop a comparative effectiveness research project, how do you need to think about really defining your question? First, you know, the starting point is, what is the patient population? You know, this is a, you know, pretty common clinical research dogma, but it's the basis is that we need to define whatever the target population is. In some cases, it can be caregivers. It can we have felt like we've actually had some success at PCORI in developing a group of projects that have already been funded, looking at ways to help parents of children with serious, severe medical disorders help to care for their children. Another example is this kind of a coexistence of more than one condition. So we've got some projects looking at how to help people who have depression and also smoke cigarettes to cease smoking, and strategies that sort of deal with particular population groups for which usual well-accepted approaches might not work as well. Next is to define the choice that the people in that population need to make. So, for example, these are just clinical examples here. You know, choosing a treatment for a new episode of low back pain. You know, are you going to go to a chiropractor, or are you going to go to, a primary care physician? You might get different kinds of treatments depending upon which provider you go to. Choosing a care management program for mental illness. This is an issue that's really important to families. Is in serious mental health disorders, usually it has to do with looking at packages of care or programs of care. And this can look often a head-to-head comparison, one clinical intervention being compared to an alternative active intervention. And sometimes it can be what I would call an add-on. It's a clinical intervention compared to the usual care that doesn't include that intervention. And when we have projects like this that use these so-called usual care comparators, we want to be careful. We want to make sure that we understand what's the milieu, what's the content of that usual care to which this other intervention is being added, so that we can really make sense and know whether the results of the study can be applied to other patient populations. So we'll go on to the next slide.
Here's the question, if you want to take
the question
now.
Let's go ahead and take the question now.
Kate, you have a question? Kate, did you disappear? Are you on mute?
Sorry. Got it. Sorry. How does cost of care, which was mentioned in the last presentation, and cost effectiveness differ, which was mentioned in this one? Because one of them was given as an outcome that we should look at, and another one was given as an outcome that we shouldn't look at.
Yeah, thanks. That's a good question, and I think we can give you an answer. So PCORI specifically is not able to support research that directly addresses questions of cost effectiveness. So really the model for clinical comparative effectiveness is that we're looking at benefits and harms of the interventions that are being compared. We're really not examining the costs of that care. And we're not able to support studies that sort of go the next step and collect cost information for the purpose of looking at, cost effectiveness comparisons. Sometimes though, there are, outcomes that are important to patients, such as out-of-pocket costs, which we are able to include in these studies. So we're able in some cases to look at costs, but nearly always these projects do not have costs as the primary outcome. Now, do they sometimes have utilization measures like, need to go to the emergency, need to get hospitalized? Those kinds of utilization measures are often included in these studies, and we would feel would be appropriate.
Yeah, and we make that clear. Naomi, you have a question as well, or a comment?
Yeah, it's a question / comment. So the way I've understood it through the methodology committee discussions is that resource is a legitimate type of outcome or utilization, and I appreciate how the example I gave, which I sort of plucked out of hand, could have caused confusion, but the one of the thrusts behind comparative effectiveness in general is, can you use it to improve both the quality and the efficiency of care? And I think that's what my example was driving at, rather than specifically a cost effectiveness analysis. Certainly, pull back on that if it's really not within the PCORI scope. As I said, it just came to mind.
Okay. So go ahead.
Okay, let's go ahead. Again, I don't know that we need to really dwell on these multiple examples, but let me just show you that first bullet, I'm pretty sure, is a rare disease question. This is a question about pediatric partial epilepsy, in which it's a study comparing three different anti-epileptic medications, levetiracetam, lamotrigine, and oxcarbazepine, on some specific harms, which have to do with the adverse cognitive side effects of those medications. And this is a study that's currently underway at PCORI, and it is addressing, I think, a very important outcome in a somewhat uncommon disease that's treated with medications. So let's go ahead and go to the next slide. And so this is the last slide. And just to kind of think about how you might bring forward a nomination of a topic. And I also want to call out that Emma prepared a really nice handout that I think was distributed to all of you, kind of a little guide sheet for thinking about topic nominations. And please take a look at that. And, if you have any questions or suggestions for edits to that document, please, send those on to us. But, so the first thing is to really think about kind of like the meaningfulness of the study, which is that there's really reason to think that there would be important differences in the benefits and harms associated with two different outcomes. I mean, if you think there's not much difference or the existing evidence tells us there's not much difference between two alternatives, we don't necessarily need to do another study to prove that. But when we don't know the difference in benefits and harms, and we suspect that there may be significant differences, and that's where a study would be useful, and that's also where gaps in evidence come into play, because you need to look at the existing evidence to really give you some insight about the need for more research. Next is, does it have a significant burden? And even if it's a rare disease, it can have very major medical impacts, and I think that's fairly easy to describe, that for the people and the families that are dealing with these diseases, that there are important burdens. And finally, can the results of the project that would take place be put into practice? Are there any significant barriers to implementation of the research that would come out of this nominated topic? So thank you very much. Appreciate the chance to be able to talk about this. And I guess we could ask if there's any questions at this point.
Are any comments relative to what Dave said, looking through the eyes of the rare disease community or concerns about rare diseases?
This is Marshall. I think, Dave, thanks for the presentation there. One of the things I think I kind of want to revisit, and I think we've talked about this a little bit before, is when we talk about, standards, grading systems, things like that with rare disease, do you feel, or does PCORI feel, that we will be using the same ones that we use in the general population of much larger data sets? Or how do you feel we'll adapt to that?
Yeah, I think it's an excellent question. I mean, I think that that we're interested in a variety of different types of studies. I think, you might think that the only thing PCORI is interested in supporting is randomized controlled trials. I don't think that's necessarily the case at all. That we're interested in well done, creative uses of other kinds of observational data. So I think what we're really looking for is, is this an important question for which new evidence would be useful? And have you figured out what's the best way to do a study that could produce this evidence? We don't believe that every study is going to, be the final word, but we really are looking to contribute to the evidence base with studies that are well designed and well carried out.
And I guess one thing I would posit, but I'd probably more ask you, Dave, from your experience in the whole process from topic selection to making positive decisions from applicants that come in. My sense is that the rare disease topics or applications have not suffered from evaluations that it's a rare disease or it just doesn't affect many people. I have never heard that. I mean, that doesn't seem to be a hindrance at all. If it affects a small number of people importantly or profoundly in any way, and it looks like the actual research could help, that would be competitive.
I totally agree, Brian. I've not seen that there's ever been a review that sort of said, well, this isn't important because it's rare. In fact, in a way, there's good opportunities in the rare disease space, because there often are big, huge evidence gaps.
Yeah, right.
And so it's pretty easy to describe the need for better evidence.
Yeah.
And then you go from there.
Yeah.
Let me ask a question. During the review process, obviously not many rare diseases made it through. Was it based more on methodological or just more on perceptual of impact?
Are you talking about the nominated topics for priority
no,
areas?
No, he's,
or
no,
talking
he's
about
the
individual
merit review.
Process?
He's talking about merit review.
Okay.
Yeah.
I think the issues have simply been the usual things about really poorly described methodologies.
But it could also be not much of a database, or that they really can't pull it off.
Okay.
I'm putting words in his mouth. I'm not sure he's agrees.
Yeah, I think that I think reviewers understand that there are deficiencies in some evidence sources, but if you're an investigator, the argument you should be making is, we figured out what's the best evidence, the best data source we can come up with.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that reviewers will respond positively to that.
Okay. Anyone else have any questions before we move on to Greg?
Okay, so let's move on to Greg. Thanks for staying here, Greg. We appreciate it. He stayed through. You can't tell, those of you who are listening, but he's been here the entire time. He's going to speak to the issue of outreach and other solutions. As you know, Bakuri has just an enormous and I think quite effective commitment to stakeholder engagement as pertains to all our stakeholder groups that care about healthcare and evidence and so forth that we're engaged in. And it's obviously it's highly germane to this particular topic right now. So, Greg, go ahead.
Thank you, Brian. As I mentioned earlier, one of the things that we're really looking to do with outreach is to get better and better quality topics nominated to us. But that's not the only thing that we're hoping to do with our outreach to the community. There's a host of different ways that we ask folks to be engaged with Bakuri, and you've heard about a number of those here today. One of the key ones that we have is actually your own participation in an advisory panel. But, of course, as you look around the virtual room right now or the live room when we're all together in the same place, there's only a limited number of seats. But we do have merit review, and we're always looking for additional reviewers to come and help us evaluate the applications we're receiving. We've also begun to stand up additional ways that folks can be engaged in research themselves. We recognize that not everybody is ready to go out of the box with a full application to Bakuri. So we've created a couple of programs in the engagement team to help foster additional capacity for participation in research, one of which we call the Pipeline to Proposals Program. This is essentially seed money to help novel partnerships between patients, stakeholders, and researchers come together so that way they can initially build and then grow that partnership to hopefully become applicants to Bakuri, but certainly applicants to any comparative clinical effectiveness research funder. Another opportunity is our Engagement Awards Program. This offers essentially wraparound support to Bakuri's larger research activities. So this can be areas like training patients and other stakeholders to participate in research, helping to create new pathways for dissemination and implementation of PCOR findings, and generally just building additional knowledge about what patient-centered outcomes research is. So those are just a few of the things that we have out there. But at one of the most basic levels of any outreach strategy is those to whom you're communicating with in the first place. And that's an area where we really believe that this panel can help help us tremendously, and that's by providing us with additional recommendations on individuals, organizations, or coalitions that might be of particular interest in PCORI or a particular interest to PCORI. So we would welcome your advice, your guidance, your wisdom on how we can really grow and strengthen our relationships with the broader rare disease community. So with that, I'll stop nattering for a moment and welcome any advice and suggestions you have or any comments that you have.
This is Jacqueline Alicani, and relating to the research networks and the topic generation and research prioritization, research outreach is really, really important, and I'm really concerned about those patients with one-of-a-kind diseases and patients with diseases that are where there are like less than 10 people or less than 5 people diagnosed. And so it's going to be outreach is really critical because I think that with these kinds of conditions and diseases, it's the patients that are going to have to really play a very, very critical role in bringing these issues to the table. So outreach and training and resources for the patients, it's very, very important. And in some cases, I think that definitely there will have to be international outreach so that there will be more patients available so that research networks can take advantage of that. So I'm really concerned about that and how we set up a protocol or subgroups to address these kind of issues, like the one-of-a-kind issues with the research networks. If there's a requirement that there needs to be greater than 50 patients available with the condition. So, you know, when we're dealing with the one-of-a-kind conditions, you individually, you have the onesies and the twosies, and then, but when you add all that together, we're talking about probably hundreds of thousands of people that have these kind of conditions. And I'm really concerned about how we can address those issues, and outreach, I think, is really critical because we're going to need the patients to come forward with those, because I think that's the way it's happened in the past mostly.
This is Marshall. That's a great point you bring up, and it's one we kind of come across when we're treating the patients too, is how do you develop standards and everything when there's 5 patients, things like that. I think one thing that will be something to keep in mind is anytime we can identify a cross-cutting question that goes across multiple rare disease, that's going to probably be a better win from the standpoint of having some impact. So I think that's something to kind of keep in mind is what are the common elements to rare disease that are unique to rare disease.
Thank you, Marshall. One thing that I wanted to actually tie on to Jackie's comment is this notion of outreach to very small populations. Oftentimes, as we all know, they may not have a well-organized coalition or organization to represent their interests or to bring them forward. It might just be some folks essentially swimming in the ocean alone. So how do we work with those folks? How do we find those folks? Are there different resources available that PCORI could tap into to help bring some of those individuals into patient-centered outcomes research?
And this is Sarita, again, from the Cornet side of things. I just wanted to add one point, which is that many of the PPRNs that we're working with are actually small grassroots networks that began with the patients. And so they actually do have some expertise in this area, and part of what we're doing in the Cornet is going to be doing some real knowledge management so that we can collect those resources and then make them publicly available.
That's great. All right.
All right. So I think the floor is yours, Marshall and Vincent, to speak in terms and make whatever comments you may have, or of course anyone else as well, in terms of what you heard, what additional issues that we should possibly follow up with.
Well, I'll tell you what, we've been at this 2 hours and 20 minutes right now. Everyone, wherever you are, if you can, stand up and stretch for just about 10 seconds. I don't know about you guys. I sit down that long. I set up. It's just one of those things. Let's kind of take this as it goes. First off, let's go a few minutes. Just go around the group. And Emma, if you just kind of call off from the folks who are on the call from the panel, and just I'd like to get an impression from everyone, just go around the room. So if you just call out the name, Emma, and then if someone would just kind of say where you think we are with some of this.
Yeah, great. So maybe we can start with Yaffa.
Yes, this is so I've been listening carefully to what I've been saying here, and I think that the thing that really struck me is the importance of paying attention what the patients really need, to provide them the information in a way that they can understand the issues around the diseases, and also what are the resources that are available to them and how to judge what is best for them. I think that sometimes they are very confused, and then because the information is not clear sometimes when it's all over, how to go about it and how to judge and evaluate it. And I would like to see some kind of forum that can help them make the right decision that they think it's better for them or best for them.
Okay, next. Emma, call off the name.
Russell Teagarden?
Yes. Can you hear me?
Yes.
Okay. Well, when you look at the schema that are put up there and some of the processes, boy, those are daunting. And to the degree we want to be able to track the rare disease community, which, you know, it's bottom up. It's not people who have been through the biosciences as a matter of interest or training. Hell, even the people who have been through bioscience training.
I was going to say, yeah.
It's terribly daunting, and it makes me wonder if there needs to be, especially for the rare disease community, like an escort service, you know what I'm talking about. I don't know what it is, but that, just looking at that, it just must put a ton of people off and say, oh, for God's sakes, I never could do that. And I wonder how many people in rare disease that might have been interested in coming forward or just say, no way. And that's what struck me.
Russell, please confirm first, I did not pay you to make that comment.
Oh, okay, I can confirm that, but I will send you a bill.
Okay, thanks.
Emma, this is Vincent Delgazzo. If I can go next, because what I have to say is not kind of along the lines of what Russell just said.
Russell, anything else you want to add before we go on?
Nope, that's it.
Okay, Vince?
Again, as more of a patient than a scientist, I found this the whole session really informative and helpful. The question that I have is, like, these presentations, like, for instance, what are considered CER topics and things like that, they're great for us, but it's not getting to the patient. And I think that's what's needed, and how to put it out there for them to come across it so that they can get involved with this stuff. And that's kind of like what Russell was talking about.
Great, thank you. Philip, Russ?
Hi. It seems that everybody's setting each other up for the follow-on questions. I made a couple of points. The formation of a comparative effectiveness research question, I think, just goes on from what Russell and Vince has just said. How do you actually get this across? How do you make it simple enough for people to understand that it's not easy for us to understand, and it's supposed to be our kind of field of expertise? But how do you make people want to actually engage with it? And then the patient-centeredness of it. The one thing that I did come back to was I was very interested in the discussion about cost. So not formal cost analysis, but, for example, if you do cost of care, are we not actually setting ourselves up for some kind of rudimentary cost analysis? You know, if treatment A is 75% as good as treatment B, but it's cheaper, are we not pushing people in that direction? And that's kind of a question I'd like to ask.
Okay, let me just jump in to answer that. Bakori does not support those kinds of studies. What was mentioned was that out-of-pocket costs are certainly of interest to us,
right,
if it's of interest to the patient population, and healthcare utilization, tracking healthcare utilization, which I do understand is a sort of a proxy for cost, but that has... we've at least supported, Bakori has supported in its policy statements and in its application guidelines that is acceptable. So we move a little bit in that direction, but we stop short of cost analysis.
Yeah, I'm glad you clarified that, Brian, because that was giving me some cause for concern.
Marty, do you have any comments to add?
Yeah, I guess, you know, as I sit back and think about how we can get more submissions that are worthwhile pursuing, I think when I look at what has been submitted, I mean, they're very rudimentary and often taught, they've been given low priority because they're just not really feasible questions in the way that they're submitted. So it's almost as if you just need to get the patients and the physicians to coordinate so that the physicians that understand trial design know what's important to the patient. Because I think a lot of times what we think is important isn't necessarily what's important to them. And they're not communicating what the real question is in a way that's getting past sort of the first gate.
Yeah, this is just a comment to that. It's not really just the physicians, Marty. It's having a researcher in there, because a lot of the physicians are not analytically trained to design studies that would get through our process. So it's both the clinic, it's sort of a tripartite sort of thing where you have the patient element, the clinical element, and the researcher or scientist element working together. And sometimes the system, if it's a systems issue. But thank you.
Cindy?
Hi. Yes, just listening to this conversation. I do agree that looking at the spreadsheet of the topics, even though many, the majority of them are not really formed questions or formed as CER questions, I wonder there's, you know, is there room, there's definitely, or I see that there is room for digging deep into some of those overarching issues just by reading through all of them. And is that something that you would consider of us proposing some topics based on just what we gather from the overall topics or that were proposed that aren't really posed as a CER question?
Yes.
Okay, yeah, because I definitely see some of those, and I think, as has been mentioned before, that maybe one could focus on common morbidities, for example, or common issues for rare diseases rather than specific diseases, or it would a way to incorporate the input from the patients or the different groups that have submitted these topics could potentially be, you know, if there's a broad RSA covering an overarching issue, is to mention the specific disorders that have been submitted, you know, by name. But that's just some thoughts.
Thank you.
But I definitely see that, you know, that there's room there for gathering some more information from the non-CR topics that were submitted.
Mm-hmm.
Great input.
Tim, would you like to make a comment?
It looks like we're not lost, Corinne.
Okay, Mark?
Hi. Fascinating call. I think my comment actually builds, so to avoid repetition, I just wanted to zero back in on Naomi's talk, and I think it picks a little bit up. My comment, I think, is similar to what Cindy was just saying. Perhaps because this is so daunting and there is fear in going it alone when you have a rare disease and you don't have companions and support to work through the system, if PCORI can facilitate the building of the collaborations or the cross-cutting issues, we might build comfort and expertise. So it had crossed my mind, just among the topics that were submitted, could we identify a subset of cross-cutting issues? Or could PCORI take something like Naomi's list and, you know, hypothetically take navigating care or coordinating complex care and specifically put out an inquiry, are there diseases that have an interest in this topic and see if there's a way to convene to try to come up with a common issue that might cut across. A lot of the rare diseases aren't going to know how to network. Certainly some are well-networked and have others that are in their space, but a lot of them aren't going to know how to network to generate that pool of people to work across issues as opposed to vertically within their disease. So I expect that we're probably best served by focusing our attention on cross-cutting diseases, at least in the near term. Cross-cutting disease issues, at least in the near term.
Today?
I don't know what to say because I think everything that needs to be said has been said. This is what I'll start with. I think one of the things I feel here that when we look at this selection process, I felt that there has been a paradigm shift. In terms of,
could you speak into the phone a little bit better?
Let me try again. Is that better?
Yes.
Thank you. Sorry for that. My microphone moved away. What I was saying was, I think this whole process of PCORI is a paradigm shift in terms of where people felt that these rare conditions, there was no way to get these issues noticed, to moving into a direction where everybody's coming up and saying, well, these are the questions that we'd like answered. Now, the issue is answering the question requires a structured research project in terms of trying to define and get to the necessary outcome. So it goes back to the process that we were talking about, which makes me think as if we, on this panel itself, need to try and put our heads together in terms of coming as a, do we need to have some sort of a wizard or some sort of an approach in terms of guiding people through how to develop their concern into a proper research question that can be followed up and can provide the necessary, I would say, clarity on the question as well as the type of answer they're trying to seek. The question is always call for help, but it has many more dimensions than that is what is just mentioned in the question. And trying to think of it in a very linear way, I think we may be losing some of the subcontext of those questions. So from my perspective, I think the question is, when we look at this as we get these questions, are we able to find or create almost a library of different collaborators, and I think somebody else had mentioned this before, in terms of trying to bring these people together, that will help us create a more higher quality question that would help us move forward. I think we are just trying to find our own footing in this. At least I feel for personally, I may not speak for everyone, where every time we come in, we are a bit more wiser than we have been before. And whatever we bring to the table gets reshaped as we get more information on this. So I would like to see if we can get together in between more and understand before we get together in D.C. to have more clarity to make this group more productive. I'll stop there.
Thank you, Uday. So that's another strong statement about the engagement process, sort of targeting the engagement awards and so forth, specifically to this community. That's what we're hearing.
Kate? Kate, are you still on the line?
And not mute? So we may have lost Kate.
Yep. Jacqueline?
Yes. And, you know, I'm really, really concerned about, you know, the rare disease patients who typically fall through the cracks and the onesies and twosies and the one-of-a-kinds. And just relating to what the point that Marshall made and some other people also regarding cross-cutting research, I think when we're doing outreach to the patients, because I really believe it's really going to be the patients that are going to be so critical in bringing those issues out, is identifying, clearly identifying opportunities for them that are in plain language that's easy to understand. And because as a rare disease patient myself, I know I'm always out there looking for resources and opportunities. And one of the great resources I found was through NORD, the National Organization for Rare Diseases, and they had on their website resources for patients to show them how to start, you know, their own outreach group and nonprofit organization or whatever they wanted to do to help do the research they needed, you know, to reach out to others and help build awareness on the condition they have. So that kind of resource is really tremendous. And I think we've really, you know, set some good strategies, and I think we're on a good course for what, you know, based on what we've talked about today and our entire agenda. It is an incredible, you know, agenda, and it's just, I think it's just phenomenal that we're looking at those issues, because it's never really been looked at in the ways that we're doing it. And so I'm really excited about the opportunities, and I think we're on a good path. I think we can get there from here, but there's still a lot of work to be done. And I think outreach is core to rare disease patients.
Okay. We exhausted the panel?
Yes.
Yeah, we probably have. I think there are a lot of people exhausted here. We can turn it back here. Go ahead, Marshall.
Yeah, no, it sounds like we've got some consensus around a couple of things. One is cross-cutting. The other is outreach. And then also, I love the idea earlier, someone came up with the concept of sort of almost a guide system or a concierge for groups wanting to do this, because unlike some of the very, very large research and disease groups, we're occasionally like amateur hour in the rare disease community because there aren't that many people around there. So I think if PCORI moving forward can develop not necessarily even personnel tools but digital tools and things to help folks through the process to form these questions properly. But I definitely think the cross cutters, and that's where groups like NORD and some of the others I think will really come in handy.
Okay. Well, I can say that as I was reviewing the PACT agenda, I was really worried that this was essentially going to be an incredibly onerous, boring, just, you know, didactic, throw out an awful lot of stuff. But I think it actually worked nicely from what I can tell. Everyone stayed engaged. We got a lot of good feedback. A lot of it is consistent with what we've been talking about, I think, in the very first meeting, and some of it's new. So I'm pleased that we did this. I think our purpose was to lay a foundation, or continue to lay a foundation so that we could move forward in a more proactive way, with the panel and get, of course, more guidance, in how to move forward. It's very encouraging that this is not strictly a research agenda. It's an engagement agenda as well. And so from our standpoint at PCORI, we've joined hands, or joined hips or something between our scientific group and our engagement group, to support the panel. And that's why I'm so pleased that you're here, Greg, and I know that you're committed to this. So I think we've come a long way. The one thing that we, and Leah as well, is Leah on the phone?
Yes.
Oh, okay, Leah.
I'm here. Thank you.
Okay, good. Thank you. So we didn't, in this wrap-up, I don't think specifically talk about the role of PCORINET and the PPRNs, but I think they're extremely important. And
Brian, I would, if I can interrupt you for 1 second, I just wanted to make a comment about PCORINET that Sarita alluded to earlier, that we would probably want to add to our agenda, and that's there's a rare disease task force in PCORINET, and they came up with a whole list of challenges for the PPRNs and CDRNs of rare diseases to meet their milestones. And we've focused, the rare disease task force has focused on a few of those to make them top priority. And I think that we should try to, if we can, help PCORINET and the rare disease task force with some suggestions on meeting those challenges at the October meeting. And our panel will learn more about the specific challenges that they have come up with at a later date, I guess.
Okay. Let me ask, this is Marshall, let me ask a couple of things of the panel. One is the idea of going ahead and proceeding with sort of a landscape review, a topic people think is worthwhile, just to kind of sort of get an inventory of what's out there and what's known. Anybody have any
thoughts?
Yep. Anybody have any strong objections to that, or think that that's not a good direction? Because I'm hoping we can identify some cross cutters that way.
Can you repeat that, please, Zoe?
Sorry. No. The one of the things we've talked about in the leadership meeting is doing a landscape review that I kind of outlined earlier, looking at what some of the models out there are already for ontologies like GRDR, like PCORINET, some of the others, but also for some of the scoring mechanisms for evidence. Things like that. So instead of kind of saying, well, let's start from scratch, let's see what's already in, let's see what's already kind of been vetted or where the gaps are, basically.
I think it's a great idea.
Yeah, I think, Marshall, this is Marty. I thought that that was something that we had agreed upon.
It is. I just wanted to make sure kind of the way we outlined it made sense to everyone.
Okay.
Yeah, Emma, update us as to where that is. Because we're in the process.
Yeah, it's still in draft form, and we're still trying to think about exactly what we want. Yeah, we're writing the statement of work, so.
For a contractor to do this.
Yes, so we're trying to determine how large the scope should be, and what details we want to find out more about.
Do we have a clear timeline?
I mean, not precisely, but I am pretty sure that we could get the RFP out in the next month.
Okay, so let's put that down as a timeline then, a commitment. Go ahead.
No, it's Marshall again. I do have a bit of a kind of a homework assignment that I'd like to tackle myself and maybe the other panel members. If you can think of some of these cross-cutting issues. In other words, take a step back from a specific disease, but think about the rare disease field in general. Come up with about a 3 or 4 or 5 sentence description of what that idea would be, and then start putting together some of those ideas to bring to the meeting this fall. That would be, I think, much appreciated. And Brian, I think I saw in the notes that there, did we want to consider the DNA testing as one to put out or not?
I don't know.
I can't remember. I know we'd talked about that. I didn't know if we wanted to, if that was ready to bring to the panel yet or not. That's something that might be useful. I've got it somewhere in my notes for that, but I wanted to make sure. Emma, you're the institutional memory. Where are we on that one?
So we just, Greg presented that question during his cross-cutting versus condition-specific topics, and we can definitely submit that question in our topic database, but then it's up to our topic generation and prioritization process that Brian explained
right.
That, you know, to see if it's going to go through or not. There's nothing, there's not much more we can do other than flesh out the question, make sure that we're happy with it, and then submit it.
I guess that's what I'm saying. Perhaps we could go ahead and flesh out that question, and maybe some input from the panel would be useful. It's something I deal with a lot, that's for sure.
Naomi has a question or comments?
I just wanted to pull together a couple of threads here and make a suggestion. And that is, if thinking about cross-cutting issues, there are a couple that are sort of outstanding in mind. Like I thought the navigation of complex systems certainly was up there. If we could identify 2 or 3 of those, we could have a landscape paper done. It's a very different direction than a landscape paper on methodology. And that landscape paper might attempt to elucidate the issues, but also what other what efforts are out there that have been made to solve these problems, whether it be in rare diseases or otherwise. I know that in cancer there's been some experimentation and interest in using patient navigators. That's just one element of navigation. But maybe if we could think about getting a landscape that would address 2 or 3 high-rising, cross-cutting issues that are potentially amenable to comparative effectiveness questions, that would help push us along, because there is a lot to work through here.
That is actually a good idea, Naomi. It is consistent with what we're seeing in our portfolio, which does have a fair number of navigating comparative effectiveness research projects, looking at alternative ways to navigate in our healthcare system. Along with that, I don't know if self-care fits in this very well, but certainly peer processes, and which I think is related to navigation. So that would be quite consistent with what else we're doing, and we could feed off the work we're doing as well as do a landscape review there.
This is Russell Teagarden. I'm not sure if this would fit or not, but one landscape that might be interesting, since you have an experience base now, I guess, would be who from the rare disease communities is on these applications, and what are their attributes, characteristics, backgrounds? I'm going to go back to what I said before. Rare disease is more than just small populations. It's bottom up, and we're asking people who are coming from about every other walk of life except biomedical research to somehow navigate it, since that's the word, or to somehow interact with it in the same way we expect people who have been doing it all their life, been trained to do it, or hire specialists to do it. And this might help discern how the processes may need to be accommodated or assisted in some way, because it's rare disease is more than just small numbers. It's the people. So is, would that fall into, you know, into what's makes sense for the organization to do is to characterize who from the communities are looking for funding?
I think that makes some sense.
Yeah, I guess we're more skeptical here.
Well, I look at those applications because I've filled out two or three of them now to no avail. But nonetheless, I filled out a few of them, and they're, I mean, they're really they assume you got a real high caliber researcher coming after this, and not only researcher but someone who is acculturated to these massive application processes and also have to confront these review panels that are used to reviewing, for the most part, applications by people who that's what their business is and they've spent years learning how to do it. It's not fair, is what I'm saying.
Yeah.
So who is applying, and does the current application process accommodate that? That to me is what makes rare disease special. People can say, look, it's not special. It's no more special than any other extreme illness that deserves some attention. So to me, when if you ask me what makes rare disease special, mostly I'll tell you it's because it's bottom up. It's people who don't come at it from biomedicine, and the accommodations that rare disease can make a claim on, I think, are the accommodations necessary to be able to interface with these opportunities in ways that are different than just the biomedical researchers know how to deal with?
Well, it's definitely doable in terms of a limited database.
I mean, one reaction I would have is that PCORI has put a lot of emphasis on engagement, patient and stakeholder engagement in the research enterprise. And I think you are basically talking about an engagement process.
Yep.
Where, this bottom-up really involves patient groups. And so in that sense, that should be a positive for seeking funding through PCORI because, one of our five review criteria is engagement. And I think it's, it is a collaborative activity. It's an activity that involves both patient groups and researchers and, and getting them to sort of work effectively together. But it seems to me that, this milieu that you're describing is a good starting point.
It's consistent with what we talked about before, which is the whole engagement awards and the PCORI engagement department working collaboratively with science here to help correct us. Not so. I think we're rolling to the hour, Vincent and Marshall.
I think we are there. I think we've either exhausted everyone or I think everyone's kind of got everything out they needed to get out. And thank you very much for the staff for pulling this together. This is very, very well done, guys.
Well, on behalf of Emma and my colleagues, we certainly appreciate the comment as you know, really truly committed to the panel and to the issue here at hand, and we very much appreciate the role you've all played so far and you continue to play in specifically your leadership, Marshall and Vincent, on behalf of the panel, and we look forward to continuing. And I think we picked up some more. Important messages to consider, and that we will not lose these and start moving forward on other channels as well.
I do believe finish on time. Yes, thank you guys.
Thank
all right.
You're welcome.
Thank you.
Thanks,
thank
everybody.
You.
Bye.
Thank you, everyone. Thank you. Bye, everyone.
Take care.
Brian, great job. Emma, are you still there?